Welcome to Color Country Politics, where we discuss all the important political issues facing Iron County, Utah. Our guests include elected officials and community leaders in or representing Iron County.
This is episode 43, Mr. Stewart Comes Home from Washington.
And welcome back to Color Country Politics. I know I say I'm excited all the time, and I usually am, I'm not going to lie, but we're really, really, really excited today. We've got Congressman Chris Stewart with us. Thank you so much for coming.
Pleasure. Thank you, Jenny, Jesse, thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Jenny Hendricks.
I'm Jesse Harris.
And we are just going to jump right in with Congressman Stewart, because I know everybody's on a time crunch today. Yep. So thank you so much
for carving out
some time in your day. Yeah. So let's just start. If you want to just give us a little bit of your history, who are you? Why are you here? Why do people in Southern Utah need to know about Congressman Stewart?
Well, okay, I'll do that briefly. Tell you both thank you for the opportunity. It's good to be able to, as we were talking earlier, have a chance to have a little more in-depth conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that's helpful. I think for people down in central and southern Utah or in the rural counties, I think the most important thing is to tell them is I'm a rural boy. I grew up in a little tiny town, about 295 people. I grew up milking cows and we ranched. I wear these boots. It's kind of funny because part of the reason I'm wearing it is because it bothers people in Washington, D.C.
So much. Does it really?
Oh, yeah. That's people are all the time, hey, what are you doing wearing boots? You're not a cowboy. You're not from Texas. I say, yeah, I've grown up ranching, so I get to wear the boots. But So I grew up in northern Utah, and I was an Air Force pilot. This is kind of cool. These are actually my dad's Air Force wings.
Wow.
He was a pilot in World War II. He had six sons. Five of us served in the military, and I have a number of nephews and nieces that serve now. Loved flying, Air Force pilot. And I remember I'd be flying. I'd go, I can't believe they pay me to do this. And by the way, I've never said that since I've been in Congress. So, this is kind of cool. I have world speed record for the fastest nonstop flight around the world.
That's cool.
I loved flying, loved the opportunity to serve. Written a bunch of books, New York Times bestseller, I was a businessman. And as I watched what was happening in our country in 2012, I thought this is insane. It was particularly regarding debt and spending, which mm-hmm. I know we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity came to run for Congress that I'm just going to do that. And here I am.
That's
so it's an honor to serve.
That's great. I was actually in the State Central Committee in your very, very first campaign, part of that whole...
That was a strange experience.
I was at that convention, and it got a little raucous.
It was in some ways really the strangest day of my life.
It was really quite bizarre.
Just really weird.
Anyway, those were the days.
You know, it's funny because it really was just a weird experience. Just so much emotion and just so much anger. And we won, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We got 62% against, I think, 11 candidates. And, you know, in this district, if you're a Republican, you're probably going to win in the general election unless you mess it up. It's a generally conservative district. And we should have gone home and celebrated. Instead, we went home and my wife was just crying her eyes out. She was like, why did we do this?
Yeah.
You know, what is this? But, you know, fortunately, you know, that passed and we've made great friends and met a lot of really good people.
Yeah.
And it's been a really good thing for us.
Super. You mentioned budgets and spending and all of that kind of stuff. That's a good segue. Let's talk about that. What are your thoughts, your positions?
When I said that's the reason I ran, it's really true. When we used to have town hall meetings when I was first elected or when I ran, if I'd ask a group of 100 people, how many of you know what the budget deficit is this year? Almost every hand went up. Mm-hmm. Because that year it was $1.4 trillion. The year before, 1.2, 1.3. We had 3 years in a row of trillion-dollar plus deficits. And everyone was aware of it. It was an issue. It was the thing I thought, we'll commit national suicide if mm-hmm. we don't fix this. Mm-hmm. So that's the bad news. The good news is that because of the Republicans taking the House as we did, we actually made huge progress to fix that. It was sequester. It was very, very painful, mm-hmm. especially on the military.
Mm-hmm.
But we took it from $1.4 trillion deficits down to about $450 or $480. 3 years in a row that we actually cut spending. First time since the Korean War we did that.
It was the most successful effort at reducing federal spending, and I feel like it doesn't get nearly the credit it deserves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a good illustration of that, Jesse, is this. When we were in the middle of that and when we had cut it, if I'd asked people what was the budget deficit this year, no one knew.
Right.
And the reason was is because it wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
And no one knew. Well, the bad news is now we're once again up above $1 trillion deficits with a Republican in the
right.
House.
Yeah.
And that's where we've got to fix this thing. And so we're back in the fight. That's where my position on the Appropriations Committee and the Budget Committee is so important. We haven't had a Utah on the Appropriations Committee since the 70s.
Oh, wow.
It's been almost 50 years. And that's where we have that fight is over our debt and our spending. Mm-hmm. And the only spending increases I've ever supported were for our military.
Yeah.
Which we had to do.
Yeah.
Look, we've got to do better at this. The good news is, again, the president, I know this because I've talked to him about it more than once, he realizes this is a problem. Look at his budget this year.
Right.
It's a sincere effort to cut spending. Mm-hmm. He took very, very difficult choices. And he's going to get a second term, I believe, and I think the country needs that. And I know he's going to be serious about trying to actually fix this problem in the second term. And by the way, if there's any president who's willing to take on really challenging problems, this president has shown that he's willing to do that.
Right. Yeah. Love him or hate him.
Yep.
You know, he can't argue with the success of a lot of his policies.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, that's just a historical fact now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the 3 years that he's had up to this point as president, has been remarkably effective.
That's
which is why, frankly, some of my Democratic colleagues hate him so much.
Yeah.
If he wouldn't have been effective, they would have just laughed at him and just let it go. But he's been so effective about instituting conservative ideas and principles. That's why they are so viscerally opposed to it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm sure that's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
We've certainly felt the effects of reduced monument size here, mm-hmm. having, you know, the public lands not be one purpose only, which is walk on your feet and
you know,
be able to have, you know, some motorized recreation and hunting and fishing and ranching and extraction.
Yeah.
That's huge.
And, you know, look, you guys aren't forced to live where you do. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful city. It's a beautiful country. You live here because you love it.
Exactly.
I loved Utah. I mean, I loved rock climb and ski. I love to sit on my back porch and just look up in the mountains.
Yeah.
And I have kids with respiratory problems. I don't like it when we get the inversions, as we do along the Wasatch Front. I mean, all of us want to, you know, try to fix those problems.
Yeah.
But the presumption is that many times people in Washington, D.C. can do it better than us.
Yeah.
People who have never been to Utah.
Right.
People who have no intention of ever coming to Utah. They sit in a cubicle in D.C. and they say, well, we know how we need these guys to manage their lands. And when I said earlier about the president being willing to take on challenges or problems, there wasn't another presidential candidate who would have said, I'm actually going to go shrink the monuments.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the previous point about we love this place, the national parks are absolute world jewels.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they absolutely should be protected. We actually have led an effort to create, it's a small park, but we want to create a national park within what was the previous monument, because we think there's about 37,000 acres there. There should be, it's truly national park worthy. And by doing that, we help relieve some of the congestion and the overcrowding in the other parks. Mm-hmm. Last thing on the parks is that, you know, the national parks has a proposal now where they want to limit access to it.
Yeah.
And you talk about the economic importance. It's about $300 million to Southern Utah.
Yeah.
They want to limit the parks, which would be about a third of the people that are, they would cut it by a third. Well, that's $100 million to rural communities.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a far better answer, and that's don't limit the number of people. Expand the access. We're working with the Zion Coalition to build another reception center, visitor center, and hotels and other amenities at the eastern entrance to the park.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to pull people over to that side of the park, which is just as beautiful.
It is,
yeah.
And it's different.
It is.
I mean, the whole thing is so incredible, but you see such different parts of it when you come into
these. And that's the answer. Don't limit people. Just make it easier for them. Look, if there's crowded in the parking lot, increase the size of the parking lot. And by the way, it's not just people from New York or Germany this is going to affect. It's going to be all of us, because we have to have a reservation as well.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
You know, for those of us who would love to go out there on a Saturday afternoon, might not be able to do that.
Yeah. No, 20 years ago, you know, you could just run down for the day or for the afternoon. I had family in town over Christmas, and we waited an hour and a half just to get on the shuttle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such an issue because it is such an incredible place, and you want to be able to share it. But you want to be able to share it appropriately.
Yeah. And you want to have that, you know, there's some of these places you want to go and be alone.
Yeah.
And part of the magic is you're not surrounded by people.
Right.
And again, part of being able to do that is to make it easier for people to get to those parks.
Yeah.
By the way, one more thing on the parks that we're leading the effort on, and that's to get these shuttle buses, which are old, but they're very useful. Get them replaced with zero emission buses, which we think is going to increase the one, their efficiency, and the other is the overall kind of experience of the park.
Yeah.
Now, to your point, I just want to make this point because I brought it up before on the podcast, is if you go to DC and you walk around, it's asphalt and concrete and, you know, 50-story buildings, maybe not 50 stories, but tall buildings. The last time we were there, my husband and I were talking, and I said, these people don't know how big an acre is.
Yeah.
They don't. They have no frame of reference. And so when these decisions are made and millions of acres are taken out of being available to the local population, it is my sincere belief that they have no idea what they're talking about. It doesn't mean anything to them because the sizes are so different when you're in a metropolitan area versus when you're out dealing with actually large acreages and public
lands. There's no question that's true, and that's such a great point. Honestly, if we were sitting in Washington, D.C., and we showed this table, and we said to people, this is an acre, almost all of them would be like, yeah.
That's right. That sounds good, yeah. So we'll just take a million of these. That's
Well, that doesn't seem like that much. And, you know, when you say, this is equal to the area of some states.
Right.
Yeah.
That's when they start to go, ooh, that is a lot,
that's
isn't
big,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all of the uses that Jesse was talking about, extraction and recreation and all of these different things, it's so important to rural areas to have access to that.
Yeah.
When 70% of the land in this state is not accessible for development because it's federal or state, that really changes the nature of what we are able to do economically.
Yeah, and it's such a burden. Look, we work with commissioners and we know how hard it is. When you take some of the southern Utah counties, as you know, 93%, 97%.
Yeah.
Imagine trying to fund your roads and your schools and basic services on 3 or 7% of your land.
Exactly.
And then they give us this PILT, payment in lieu of taxes, which is pennies on the dollar.
And then we have to go fight for
that's
that.
That's right. I was just going to say, you have to come back and beg for it. Please give us pennies on the dollar.
So
that's one of the things where being on the Appropriations Committee, we've been, and I don't know why, it seems to me like some of my colleagues from the West should fight with me, but for some reason that's become my fight, the PILT payments.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things I'm just pushing hard to do is to get that on the mandatory spending side so at least they know that it's coming every year and how much it will be. And these guys, poor commissioners and other leaders don't have to come back and, as I said, please give us our PILT payments.
No, that's huge. That's huge.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. You know, while we're kind of on that topic, let's kind of segue into wild horses and agriculture. Give us your positions and your thoughts there.
Well, I mean, anyone who grows up ranching or farming has got a great life, and we want to protect that. I wish, in a real sincere way, I wish I could have raised my kids like I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can make them mow the lawn and make their bed, but it's not the same thing.
Right, exactly.
But you know, it's a lifestyle that has to be protected, and it's honored here in the West.
Mm-hmm.
One of the dangers to that is, honestly, this other thing that we truly love, and that's wild animals, including our horses.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I could go into this a long time, but I'll just make it very quickly. We know that the Wild Horses and Burros Act is supposed to allow for 27,500 animals. Mm-hmm. There's something more than 100,000.
Yes.
Here's the stunning thing about this. It doubles every 5 to 6 years. And I used to carry around a picture of a starving foal in my pocket, and I was showing my Democratic colleagues, this is what's happening out in Utah. Please help us. And it took 5 years of hand-to-hand combat, political combat, to convince them, but we did convince them. You really have to help us with this. If you care about animals, starving
them to death
is not an animal.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
Everyone's got this image in their head of, you know, majestic animals running across these open fields. And it's like, no, these are scrawny, starving animals.
Right.
They're crowding out the native species.
Yeah.
And these are really just abandoned animals that have been around for a while.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're destroying the habitat. They're destroying elk and deer habitat. They're destroying the rangeland.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing on this. Underneath this starving foal was just dust. Because they chew down below the blade line of the grass, and it destroys the range.
Yeah.
The good news is we've actually convinced them, and it took, like I said, 5 years of political hand-to-hand combat for my Democrat, because they were like you, Jesse. They're like, oh, these majestic stallions running free. And it's like, no, that's not it.
Yeah.
So we actually got $50 million this year to move towards, you know, permanent fix on this problem, and it's going to take, you know, probably 5 or 7 years to manage these herds, but we are going to be able to do it now.
That's right. I know our local commissioners have been screaming for that for a long time. So
and they should.
And
they've been a great partner with us.
That's fantastic. That's great. Okay. Let's see.
So that's something that
lots of political stuff to get into here.
I'll throw out the next one. I know that you recently have said that the FISA courts are desperately in need of reform. For people who don't know, that's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to allow for a secret warrant in case of a foreign entity needing to be monitored. I know for a long time you've been a staunch proponent of keeping it as is, but what led you to say, hey, wait a minute, this is actually not working the way that we think it's supposed to?
Because we realized how it had been abused. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so a former Air Force pilot sit on the House Intelligence Committee. National security is the reason I'm in Congress, or at least one of the main reasons. And I understand this as well as anyone in the country. But the presumption was, before the FISA courts, that you would have a Department of Justice and FBI that would tell them the truth. Mm-hmm. And we know that they didn't. And you got to say, God bless the House Intelligence Committee, because we are the ones who discovered this. We're the ones who informed the American people, and we were called traitors. We were said we'd violated our oath of office. We violated national security. We revealed sources and methods. It was nonsense. It was just by people who were embarrassed and should have been embarrassed by what we were telling people. And it turned out every word of what we've been saying for 3 years is true. Mm-hmm. And we know that now. And so if you sit on the FISA court, the vast majority of the cases brought before them are with foreign people. Mm-hmm. They're actually foreign terrorists. Have no problem with that. That's a very important tool. We got to keep that. But for the small percentage that are Americans, we now know that's very clear the Department of Justice and FBI lied to them and manipulated the courts. And so we've got reforms that would fix that. And by the way, if we can't fix it, then I would not reauthorize FISA. Mm-hmm. We have to either fix this or get rid of it. And look, they're very simple things. Like for those cases that are U.S. persons, we would appoint an advocate, someone who's in the court to protect that person's constitutional rights. Another very simple thing. There's no transcript of the FISA courts, and there's a transcript of every other court proceeding. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, there are some of them are transcribed and some of them aren't. And it's an interesting question, isn't it? If you have before the FISA court a case where you're actually authorizing a surveillance on a U.S. presidential campaign, wouldn't you think that would be one they'd say, maybe we ought to transcribe this and have a record of this, and they didn't. And when you read this FISA application, look, I'm not an attorney. And I may not be the smartest guy in the room, but I'll tell you this. You read that application, and there it begs for questions. There are enormous holes in this. And then you wonder, well, did the judges ever ask these questions? We have no idea, because there's no transcript.
Yeah, reports are that they didn't know how to approve it.
That's right. And if there was a transcript required, it would compel the judges to be more curious and not just accept the Department of Justice case. Well, another thing. We know there's four judges that were assigned this case because it went for reapplication four times. Well, we are pretty sure that the second and third judges and fourth just relied on the fourth judge's judgment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're like, well, the first judge looked at it. Surely he was careful. We'll just sign it on.
Yeah.
And so we want to assign it to a judge and have him be responsible for the entire application. So it's his responsibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are common sense things.
Right.
But if we did this, they wouldn't be able to abuse it. And they would be much more careful.
Transparency creates accountability.
That's exactly right. And that's all we're trying to do here.
And you see that borne out in the statistics of FISA of since its inception in 1978, I can count on my fingers the number of times that applications were denied.
Yeah.
And you think, well, that's a heck of a batting average. Does anyone ever get it right that often? Yeah.
There's a couple explanations for that. One of them is the problem we've been discussing here. And that's clearly part of it. Another one is that the final numbers don't include the ones that were rejected and they said, go back and do this. And then we might approve it. Mm. So it is the final approval, but there were many of those, they were deficient and they required them to go do additional work. So it's not quite as bad as that number indicates, but the problem is still obvious. And if it happens one time, which it clearly did, it happened too much. Mm-hmm. And if it happened one time, it will happen again.
Yeah.
If we don't fix it.
Yeah. No, you usually don't get caught on your first time.
That's right. And the other thing is we know, and believe me, my kids learn that, don't get caught the first time, as I did. but we know, too, if you give the government power, it will eventually abuse it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you have to have that oversight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of oversight, let's talk about the Salt Lake Tribune article. About your potential appointment to intelligence director position.
Yeah. And it's actually a New York Times article that started that. And I worked with the reporters and I was like, please don't report this.
So it's good that you have that great relationship with the reporters.
That's exactly. And there's no such thing as fake news.
That's basically daring them to at that point.
And I'm glad this actually came up because I get asked all the time about it now. And look, the president and I truly do have a kind of unique relationship. And I think... I know he views me as a leader in national security and on intelligence, and I think he respects what I do. And I'm honored that he feels that way. But he also knows that my priority has always been to my work here, mm-hmm. to the 2nd Congressional District. And honestly, Utah needs me.
Yeah.
As I said, sitting on House Intelligence, sitting on Appropriations, sitting on Budget, the things that we're involved with. I'm one of the most senior congressmen. Yeah. Right now.
No flyover country needs a strong advocate.
We do, absolutely. And we need someone who's got a relationship with the White House. And I represent, and I really mean this, and the people who know the district know it's true. It is the most beautiful district in the country, mm-hmm. and it's the greatest district. Mm-hmm. I have downtown Salt Lake City. I have, you know, these beautiful parts of rural Utah. And I've made so many friends here, and I just feel like the state needs me and the country needs me here, and we're just going to keep working on my work here in the district.
Okay.
So you're definitely running again.
Definitely running again. We're going to win.
Okay.
We're going to do everything we can to win, and we're going to keep serving the people in the 2nd District of Utah.
Excellent.
Okay.
That's great. Well, let's turn now to something that I know is near and dear to your heart and something that you've been working on is the suicide hotline, suicide prevention hotline. So give us kind of some history on that and... why is it important? Why do we need such a thing?
Thanks for asking that question, because it really is important. It's not one that comes up very often. Mm-hmm. So the good news is that we're talking about it now, mm-hmm. and that's helpful for people. Mm-hmm. When I went to Congress, I had no idea, the scope of the problem, nor that I would become, you know, really the kind of the leader on this. It just kind of happened. But you know, I talked earlier about how if we were in a group of people and asked what the deficit was, they'd all raise their hand. This is another example of that. 5 years ago, if I had a group of 100 people, I said, how many of you have been impacted by suicide? No one would raise their hand. They'd all look around like, you know, I don't want to say
it. I don't want to talk about it.
But they were embarrassed or, you know, ashamed or awkward. Mm-hmm. But now, and this is really such a good thing, if you ask those same 100 people, the shocking truth is that almost everyone.
Almost everyone.
That's right.
Someone that they know,
someone in their family, mm-hmm. someone that they love. And it's important for people to know that they're not the only ones. Because imagine the first example where I said, how many of you have been impacted by suicide or attempted suicide, and no one raises their hands? If you're one of those people who have been, you look around and you go, I'm the only guy in the room.
Yeah.
No one understands you. And it's important for people to know you're not alone. And there is help, mm-hmm. and all of us have been impacted in some way. Mm-hmm. So having had that in my own life, I understand how devastating that is for families, mm-hmm. for the survivors.
Right.
And the second thing I understand is we can help. There is help. So that's why we wanted to do this National Suicide Prevention Hotline number. If you were in the middle of a mental health crisis or you're worried about one of your children or maybe your spouse, no one knew who to call. And it was different here in Iron County than it would be in St. George, mm-hmm. and maybe in Salt Lake or Las Vegas or wherever. So we wanted to have a national number, 988, and we want everyone to know, and they soon will know. It'll actually go live in next January, and by that time we hope that we've got the public informed. 988. Now, if you are in the middle of a mental health crisis, call 988. You're going to get help. And you know, one other just remarkable thing. And that is 90-something% of people who have considered or attempted suicide and don't or are not successful go on to live happy, productive lives.
Exactly.
And we have to show those people it's not over. The way you feel right now is not how you will feel forever. Mm-hmm. There is hope for you. You won't feel this hopelessness, this despair forever. Mm-hmm. It can change. But we have to have that access. We got to have them.
You got to stop it in the moment so that you can get the mental health help to them.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And then we're following it up with another bill that deals again with collecting data, trying to understand, you know, the depth of the problem, how to actually, you can't try to fix it until you understand it.
Right.
You know, a lot of people are really, really surprised when they learn that Utah, 5th highest suicide rate in the country per capita. Because we think of ourselves as being, you know, we're a healthier culture, there's something different about us. And that's true, I think,
We're kind of we're going to plow our way through sort of a culture.
I think that's true.
And no one wants to talk about it.
That's right. And the other thing is, I think we're family-centered, mm-hmm. we're community-centered. We think we have more resources, more help in that way. But there's something going on in Utah for a while, especially among our youth.
Yeah.
And we just have to understand it better.
That's great. Well, what else do you want to communicate to the people in Southern Utah who are going to be listening? What's important for us to know about what you're doing?
Well, I think we've talked about most of them. And people are probably getting bored with politics.
Our audience does not get bored with politics.
Well, good. No.
You can tell us your favorite places to eat.
Come to DC and the shows. Okay, since you brought that up, and I wasn't going to mention this, but it's actually be kind of fun to mention that, is we have people come to DC all the time. And I'd love for people to know, if you're going to come back to DC, let us help you. We can take you on tours. We can show your family some things that are just a lot of fun and you wouldn't get to see otherwise. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, there's a lot of times I get on the airplane and I fly home and I'm a little frustrated and I want to bang my head against the window. And go, right. You know, what have we done this week, right? But the reminder to me of the good news on that, and that is we help people back home. Mm-hmm. So to your viewers or listeners, if you've got a problem, if you're a veteran and you're having trouble with your VA benefits, if you're having trouble with Social Security, immigration, you know someone in your family with an immigration problem, meaning any number of questions, call us. We can help you. And we love to help. And anything with federal government, we want to be your advocate, and we will, and we can often make a huge difference. And I guess the last thing I would say is, you know, we've been down here for Lincoln Day breakfast and dinners, and, you know, we have President's Day coming up, and it's not one of the holiday that I think we think about maybe appreciate as much as we could. But if you talk about Lincoln, and I say this only about 8 billion times, so if you've heard me and some of your listeners have, but it's just worth saying again, and that is, you know, Abraham Lincoln, who is my hero in many ways, he said, he has this phrase, and I have it on my wall back in D.C., and it's his second inaugural where he says, the United States is the last best hope on earth.
Yeah.
And I know people are discouraged. I get that. I understand politics is very divisive right now. I get that. But all is not lost. Mm-hmm. And I think God still cares about this country. And I think there's a way forward for us. And we have to preserve that. We have to maintain that. We are the last best hope on earth.
Very well said. I think that's a beautiful place to end.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thank
Congressman
you.
Chris Stewart, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great
thank
information. Justin, appreciate you coming on. This has been Color Country Politics with Chris Stewart. And we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Color Country Politics, a production in cooperation with Utah Politico Hub and graciously sponsored by Century 21 Prestige Realty at 121 North Main Street, Cedar City. Special thanks to Amoeba Crew for use of their song Background Indie Rock, licensed under Creative Commons. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Also, check out our YouTube channel where we post video of our interviews. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and our website at www.colorcountrypolitics.com.